You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Bible for Normal People. Today, you're in for a treat. It is our 100th episode. And so to celebrate, we're going back to the beginning. And by the beginning, we mean Genesis. And we mean that in a few different ways. First, we want to shamelessly plug the release today of the second edition of our book, Genesis for Normal People. In a lot of ways, that book started everything that we do now, the podcast and everything. And we have upgraded it. We have some wonderful new additions, some maps. There's a study guide at the end in case you want to go through it with some groups. So if you're listening now and you're not driving, I would encourage you just pause this. You can go to Amazon. You can go anywhere where books are sold online. You could go to thebibleformalpeople.com, thebibleformalpeople.com/books. And pick up a copy. Maybe pick up five or six if you want to start a small group and pass those suckers around and get that group started. We are all about the community, the conversation. So we hope that this is helpful in furthering that.
Let's talk microdosing, as you'd expect from a Bible podcast. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good.
And you know, microdose gummies are good for so many things like anxiety, workflow, sleeping, and stuff like that. I mean, Jared, we've had people in our lives that have benefited from this too, not just us.
Yeah, I have a family member who regularly uses microdosing for more creative, like recreational time, a time they journal every night and it's sort of a way to unwind and do the journaling. And that's worked really well for them.
Our producer. It's made such a difference, folks. I can't even tell you that. So anyway, and for me as well, microdose gummies help me a lot with anxiety and sleep and just stopping that racing mind at night. And it helps tremendously. I get a good night's sleep. So get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com. Promo code Normal People. It's available nationwide.
That's microdose.com, promo code Normal People for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code Normal People.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Now, what are we talking about today, Pete?
Yeah, so we just thought we'd talk about Genesis. It's that book that keeps giving. And, you know, questions that I get, at least a lot of them, have to do with the kinds of issues that come up in Genesis. Actually, you know, studying Genesis, like every academic issue you can think of comes up in this book. It's almost like a laboratory for studying how to study the Bible. Now, we're not going to get into all that kind of stuff.
But yeah, there's a reason it's been a bit of a lightning rod book over the last 100 years when it comes to biblical scholarship, mm-hmm. because we're going to—
Even longer, but modern period, sort of, like, you know, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll spend a little bit of time on some of the, maybe we might call it the more academic, historical, critical issues, but we talk about that quite a bit in other places and other times, so we also then want to move to some more themes that maybe are important, but maybe not obvious.
Yeah, that's sort of like, oh, I had noticed that before. That might actually affect how I read this book.
Right. So let's start with this, kind of the things that have maybe been talked about, maybe over-talked about, but we're going to talk about them again, which is myth, legend, historicity, and maybe you can give a context real briefly, Pete, on what has shifted in the last 100, 150 years when it comes to reading Genesis.
Yeah, a lot of stuff. You know, it goes back to really at least, I mean, even before this, but for our purposes, maybe the 18th century when geologists started discovering that, oh, the Earth's really old, like not 6 or 10,000, like much, much older than that. And that was a big sort of kick in the teeth for people. And I'm sure it would have been for me, too, if I were living in the 18th century. And it's things like science that have affected how we understand Genesis, like the age of the Earth and how old is the universe even, because Genesis is about creation. And archaeology has affected things that really started going in earnest in the 19th century, where you began unearthing tablets from ancient Babylon and ancient Assyria and other places that had stories of creation that were certainly different from the Bible stories, but also pretty clearly they breathed the same air, so to speak. They had certain assumptions that they shared. And biblical scholars just knew right away, like, you can't read Genesis exactly the same way anymore, because now it's affected by this other stuff that we know. The more we've come to know about antiquity in general, it's affected Genesis, which is a book about beginnings.
So what we discover in other fields and other areas now impact, right? So if we think of the Bible making, say, historical claims, and we're learning about geology and archaeology and these things, we have to start reconciling when they're not compatible.
Right. And even what it means to say the Bible is making historical claims, because we're already assuming something there that their history is the same as our history and they're thinking the same way. And that's one thing that the study of things like archaeology has, I think, pretty clearly put to rest. They had different conceptions of what it meant to write about the past.
Well, I think that's an important point, because in some ways then you can see all these scientific discoveries as actually helping us read the Bible in maybe a more faithful or maybe a more accurate way, because we are no longer able to make those assumptions that they are writing history the way we think they should have written history. We're not coming to those, you know, Bishop James Usher conclusions that we can pinpoint exactly the time, right? I think he said the world was created on October 23rd of 4004 BCE.
Something like that, yeah. Like at 9:30 in the morning.
Exactly, yeah. It was in the morning for sure.
Because he crunched all the numbers like in Genesis, and he came up with that date, which is making an assumption that the Bible is giving you all information necessary to discern how old the universe is, which is really a very modern question, not an ancient question. Mm-hmm. It's worth asking if the ancient writers of the Bible were even really all that interested in exactly when things began, because as we'll get into this, the story of Genesis moves pretty quickly to what Israel is and not so much just like humanity in general. It's actually not that interested in humanity in general, only as a backdrop to the real story that has to be told, which is Israel's story.
Well, and I think I don't know how deep we want to get into specifics here, but right out of the gate, which I feel a little betrayed by this because I didn't really think about this or learn this until seminary.
Poor Jared. Jared felt betrayed.
But okay. Right out of the gate, you have two creation stories. So Genesis 1:1 to Genesis 2:4, and then the second half of that verse through chapter 3, and they don't say the same thing. So it baffles my mind how we have all these systems of thought, we have actually universities and other field like proposing that it is, and then right in the first two chapters we have two different accounts that actually contradict each other.
Yeah, they're not compatible, and the thing is that I think we can safely assume that whoever was responsible for putting these stories next to each other knew that. You know, when we say they're not compatible, well, yeah, they're not compatible if what we're looking for is sort of a straight historical account of what happens. But, you know, I mean, we could get into the details there. I think maybe we shouldn't get into all of them, maybe just one or two. Yeah. Like the enemy of Genesis 1 is chaotic water, and the problem in Genesis 2 is a dry desert. You have two different enemies that have to be addressed. And the big one is just the order of creation. In Genesis 1, the last things created are male and female sort of en masse. But in the second account in Genesis 2, the Adam and Eve story, you have Adam, then the animals, and then the woman at the end. And try as you might, these things are pretty clearly not meant to be reconciled in our sense of the term. The question is more, what are those stories doing? And one way of looking at it is Genesis 1 is telling the story of creation as a whole. And in Genesis 2, we're starting to narrow the story down to something more specific, which is the story of Israel.
I think you said something that's actually really important and worth reiterating, which is the modernist assumption. We think of people who criticize Genesis 1 and 2 as being directly opposed maybe to fundamentalists who think of Genesis 1 and 2 as literally, historically, what's true. But what they share is the assumption that that's what the Bible should do. So
right.
People who dismiss Genesis and say, look, there's a contradiction right here, and then they throw it out, are really assuming, they're very similar to the fundamentalists.
Yes.
Who
yes.
are assuming the same thing, that what we have here is a historically accurate account that takes account of, you know, it, that's what they're trying to do. So I think what you said is really important to recognize, that our assumption, and I think it's the assumption of most biblical scholars, would be these editors aren't dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, actually, we should go behind that and say, why did they put these together? That's right. a more interesting and fruitful question than, oh, these stupid editors, or, oh, nothing to see here. They're not actually contradictory at all.
They're exactly the same, because they have to be, because God wouldn't lie to us.
Right.
And I get it, but sometimes, I mean, this is almost impossible to do, but make believe, like, step away from Genesis and try to just scrub all our assumptions away from it and just read it. And what do you come away with? And I'm not sure if history is the first word that will come to our lips, especially if you compare that to other ancient stories of the ancient world that, again, I'm going to stress this, are not the same. There are no two nations that have the same creation stories, but there are similarities. And we would never say of those, well, gosh, it must be history because it's written down. But the assumption there, Jared, of course, is that, well, the Bible is inspired, and God would never inspire something like what we typically call myth, right? Which is more than just a story that's, quote, not true or a lie. A myth is an attempt to explain the nature of reality for people living at certain times. And not to get too deep into it, but some would even say science is a modern myth. It's a way of explaining all of reality. And I don't think science actually does that, but it's a myth that some, for some, it explains all of reality. And we all have that. All cultures have these big stories that try to, like, tuck everything together. And ancient people had their way of doing it by telling and, about the past, the deep past, and what's going up in the heavenly realms and stuff like that.
Well, we do that too. And I would say as Americans, we have our own founding myths about how America, we don't maybe aggrandize it into a creation account, but in some ways we still, if you read those early accounts, God is still invoked in sort of the creation of America. And we, I would say I grew up not really understanding the difference between the facts of those and the myth of those, because it wasn't, even I would say in our modern education, I don't think it was necessarily the point to give us just the historical facts. But there was some propaganda, there was some myth-making as a part of that.
Right.
So I think we still do that today. Maybe yeah. we pretend
Well, our
we
nation's
don't.
Certainly done it. You know,
right.
I mean, not to get too political.
Right.
Why not? Who cares? But, you know, it's – even on the East Coast, you know, where we live, you have towns called Bethlehem or New Canaan. That's part of the origins myth of our nation, which is taking the biblical origins myth and making it our own.
Yeah,
right? And so now we here we are, right? So the, I guess the big point, Jared, is like everybody does this. This
right.
is not unusual. And here's the question, I guess the theological question, does God have a problem doing this or with people doing this? And the assumption usually is, well, no, God wouldn't lie. God would be accurate. God would not mislead us. But again, that's making assumptions, like if it's not straight history, it's misleading us. And God can't somehow work within the parameters of ancient ways of doing things.
And it makes the assumption that the most important thing in our world is accuracy.
Right.
Which that's an assumption. I don't know where we get that from.
And so God says, okay, here are two creation stories you can't reconcile, so let's put this to bed real fast, right? Oh, gosh.
But
the sound of God's
But God would never do that when we get to the New Testament. Oh, wait. No, we start with
four
stories.
Four Gospels. Oh, gosh.
Well, I want to go back to something you said because I think it'll transition us well, which is,
okay.
You know, whenever we're talking about, say, these two passages in Genesis – Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, well, they don't actually go together, but it's a more interesting question of saying, why is it there? And you mentioned kind of if you just read the story closely. So I think there are some themes that come out of the stories in Genesis, the book of Genesis, if we read it closely and ask that question, why is it there?
Right.
Why does this look the way it does?
Right.
And then we start to see, oh, that looks like this over here.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, that's a pattern. That's a theme running through
right.
this. So just to kind of transition us into that second question we started with, which is what are some of these important but maybe not obvious themes in the book of Genesis?
Well, actually, you know, before we go there, there's another element to that. Just read the Bible. Just read Genesis. And what do you come up with? That is a big part of how the modern study of Genesis came about, where people started having theories about, you know, I'm not sure if Genesis was written by one person at one time. It seems to have in it different traditions. And again, like you just said, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are two different accounts of origins that biblical editors at whatever point in time, most think it's after the exile to Babylon, so in the late 6th century or even in the 5th century, even later in the 4th century, that these traditions were put together in the way we know them today. It isn't like somebody, you know, 2000 BC wrote Genesis as it is, but there are traditions that developed in Israel's life that were brought together and respected and put next to each other. The writer and the editors rather want us to respect these texts. But you see, it's an innocent sort of, and it's an innocent reading, maybe that's the way to put it, of Genesis that led people to say, you know, why are these two stories so different? And why do we see a similar pattern elsewhere in Genesis, which gave rise to something that we've had podcasts on called source criticism, which is a very boring and tedious title, but it just means there are different sources. I like to use the word traditions that are respected in Israel's past. And when they compile their books, they're going to keep as many of those as possible. And sometimes they put them next to each other, like Genesis 1 and 2. Other times they weave them together in the same story, like the flood story seems to have those characteristics, which you'll have to read our book if you want to get some of these details. Yeah, we don't want to do that. It's just there are modern questions that scholars have been asking that have become sort of part of the conversation. Like, is this history? Well, it's not history the way we think of it, that's for sure. Myth is a good word to use for a lot of Genesis, maybe not all of it. And there may be some legendary parts too when you come to the patriarchs, and maybe some what they call historical memories or echoes of the deep past. So it's very complicated, and it can't just be like an either or. This is entirely historical, or there's nothing of historical value here. It's really, really difficult to make those kinds of distinctions. And that's something I think that modern scholarship brings to the forefront.
And it comes from, I think I appreciate what you said, because a lot of times it's like, well, the only way you would come up to that is if you had some ulterior motive or some evil agenda to take the Bible down. But it actually is this close reading that leads us to say, why is it that the first creation account, or in the first two chapters, let's say, or the first chapter of Genesis, they only use Yahweh as the divine name?
Elohim.
Elohim in the first chapter. And then in the second, it becomes
Yahweh. That's his name, yeah.
And so then it's like, well, a close reading of that. Like, all we're doing is actually just asking questions, why is this like this, when we do a close reading of the text?
Right.
And I think that's just been a theme of this whole podcast, is that taking the text seriously leads us away from reading it literally and ask more critical questions so we can more deeply understand what actually is going on and not just overlay our assumptions about what it has to be.
Right.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever.
I was worried about talking about Fast Growing Trees on here because I'm not a green thumb, but then I realized that probably makes me the perfect candidate to be able to talk about this. I loved the website. It was so easy. It was searchable by region. And then the experts who are there to help you make the decisions lowers the anxiety around something I don't typically know a lot about, but it was a really good experience.
This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on selected plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout.
That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code NORMALPEOPLE. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And people who, even long before the modern period, were reading the text very, very carefully and noticing some of these same things. Now, they might have explained them a little bit differently, but they noticed them, right? And that's why a careful reading of the Bible is a beautiful thing. It could also be a rather deconstructing thing at times, because it simply doesn't match as neatly as maybe some of us were taught at some point in our lives.
Well, and in some ways, then the text at close reading is prophetic in the sense that it criticizes our own assumptions and ideologies that we've brought to it. And it, if you would allow it, it starts to break some of those things down.
Modern Western assumptions are not eternally correct and protected. I know, and protected from all criticism and never has to be looked at critically. A real critical approach means you're critical of yourself as well when you read it. That doesn't hamstring you. It actually frees you to explore the text and to engage people of the past who have engaged it as well. And so you learn from the past. You learn from this long line of people who have really thought deeply about a book like Genesis.
I think that's an important point to mention that we – because I do think, you know, biblical scholars can also get arrogant and they can start to think that they stand over the text and say, we are just going to adjudicate what it is. And they don't allow the text to actually criticize their own assumptions.
Right.
And we just, you know, we do a book study, and I think a lot of the books have really great value from these scholars. But one criticism that keeps coming up is like, well, they seem to be not allowing the text to criticize their own assumptions.
Right.
And so they already come up with an idea, then they overlay it onto the text, and it highlights some really good stuff.
Right.
But then they take it too far, and they don't realize the text is resisting it at that point.
And modern scholars have definitely been guilty of that. Of course, they're not the only ones who are guilty of that.
Right.
Everyone is guilty of that.
Exactly.
And there is a certain humility, I think, that comes from actually just paying attention to these texts and saying, you know, there's more here than I thought there was, and I'm not exactly sure how to put it together. And that's not a cause for panic. That's a cause for anticipation. And, you know, once you take off the table that you've got to be right, like immediately, because it's the word of God. If I don't get the – I should get this complete – okay, God's clear. God is completely clear, and I should get this right away. If not, there's something wrong with me. And so we start forcing things into a mold that actually disrespects the text at the end of the day, because it's diverse, and it's a little bit hard to get a handle on, which is why Jews and Christians have had to study this stuff for a very, very long time.
Well, with that, the complexity – the nuance, it does require a close reading. And that's some of these themes that we wanted to talk about only come out of that close, nuanced reading. It's not always clear.
Right.
It is kind of complicated when you see this. And, you know, you mentioned source criticism. One of the things, if you think about or you locate where this Genesis text finally came from, if it's post-exilic, if it's after the exile, then you would expect some of the themes of that day to be connected to the Genesis story, right?
Yeah.
And so we can; those are some of these themes that we can find woven in through the Genesis text.
Yeah, there are themes that help us understand something of like maybe when Genesis was finally compiled and what value this would have had to them, right? Because whoever was responsible for this wasn't just sort of thinking, I need to write about the past for the sake of the past. The past is always written about for the sake of the present. And frankly, that goes for, I think, modern history too, writing, because people don't just say, let's randomly talk about past things. There's some connection to helping us understand who we are today.
I think one of the first things maybe we can talk about is this wisdom connection, because I do think at the time of the post-exilic time, that was flourishing. There was a lot of wisdom writing and literature and things going on. And you've mentioned, and maybe just explain a little more, how the Joseph story connects to these themes of wisdom.
Yeah, what's interesting about Joseph, I mean, Joseph has been called sort of like a wisdom story by a lot of scholars, a wisdom novella, sort of a little novel. And you have themes in there, like for example, think of the book of Proverbs, right? The book of Proverbs, how much talking does God do in the book of Proverbs? Zero. There's not the voice of God. There's a voice of wisdom. There's a voice of elders. Well, in the story of Joseph, God does very little to no actual – talking. It's people living and working and doing the best that they can to understand the way forward. And in Joseph's case, it's a matter of him gaining wisdom over time.
Hey everyone, I'm Rob Buckingham from Melbourne, Australia, and I'm part of the producers group here at the Bible for Normal People. This podcast is brought to you by supporters on the Patreon platform. For as little as $1 a month, you can be part of the group that brings this podcast to normal people everywhere. And you'll benefit from lots of resources at patreon.com/thebibleformnormalpeople. One thing I appreciate about being part of this podcast is the honest discussions Pete and Jared have broadened my understanding, appreciation, and love for the Bible. If you're grateful for this free podcast, please do consider supporting Pete and Jared at patreon.com/thebibleformnormalpeople. And consider rating and reviewing the podcast on iTunes too. That can go a long way to help others find us. One group we want to thank is our producers group, who continue to help the podcast improve. And so, thanks to Sean Bloom, Joel Beebe, Amber G, Eric Hendricks, David Hundley, Manuel J. Gomez, Jeff Polis, and Aaron Brown. The Bible for Normal People couldn't happen without you. Now, back to the podcast.
That's a progression that we see, right? We begin with in the beginning God.
Right.
And God's heavily involved in the first part. Mm-hmm. God speaks directly to Abraham. There's this heavy connection with God's involvement in the affairs of men and women. And that slowly disappears until we get to Joseph, where God's pretty absent.
Yeah. I mean, if you ever read Genesis, just, you know, the story of creation, Babylon, all that stuff, and then Abraham, God is very involved, does a lot of talking. And with Isaac, he's pretty involved. And with Jacob, however, read the story of Jacob and count how many times God actually talks. It's not very frequent. It's there, but it's not very frequent. And then read the story of Joseph, which is like the last, 13 chapters of the book. And it's interesting how behind the scenes God is. Now, God is acknowledged. You know, Joseph says at the end to his brothers, you meant this for evil, but God meant it for good. God is clearly acknowledged. I'm not saying like they're atheists or something, but it's just God as a character in the book. God as a character becomes less in the forefront and more in the background, which is why, you know, when you get to the end of the book of Genesis, it's more something that we can connect with, because for us, God is also more in the background. God doesn't speak audibly and say, go sacrifice your son, Abraham. We don't hear stuff like that. And when we do, we usually think there's something wrong with you, like you need to go to the hospital or something. So that alone is just an interesting dimension of the book of Genesis, that as you go on, God speaks less. So it's you have these human beings doing the best they can, and at the end, things come out well for them. And that's a theme of growth in wisdom and understanding. Joseph learns things. He starts off, Jared, as sort of a whiny little baby, right? I mean, his father just loves him so much and gives him this. Okay, Joseph's daddy's favorite, right? Gives him this coat of many colors, as it's sometimes translated. And what does Joseph do? He goes out there and he shows off to his brothers, you know, dad loves me more than you. Oh, by the way, I had a dream, and one day you're going to bow down and worship me. It's right, and that's part of sort of a wisdom-y kind of theme as
right.
well.
It's not a right and wrong category.
Right. And also that this is a dream-induced sort of revelation, that there's a wisdom theme in there as well. But, you know, you have Joseph, who starts off as a jerk, and at the end, you know, he's a pretty upright guy. I mean, he's learned a lot. And in between, you know, with Potiphar's wife, you know, resisting the adulterous woman. Well, read Proverbs 1-9. You've got this adulterous woman who's all over the place. And you know, that doesn't mean that you just equate Proverbs and Genesis, but there's a wisdom theme there too. And, you know, a growth in moral upstandingness, you know, for Joseph, whatever we want to say. It seems that wisdom is an important theme there.
I would tie that to the theme maybe too of this, the younger brother and the humility. Mm-hmm. The humility that comes with triumphing or victory, if you will. Mm-hmm. So there's this definite theme that the younger brother wins out
in some ways.
Right.
But there's always, well, I don't know about always, but I'm going back to Esau and Jacob too, mm-hmm. where Jacob, the younger brother, does a lot of shady stuff, but has this encounter with God. And at the end, maybe not as stark as Joseph, but there's still a bit of a transformation.
Right.
Where he seems more humble.
Mm-hmm.
He seems wiser.
Right.
And so we see that in almost like the further God becomes absent, the more nuanced and wise these developments become mm-hmm. among the characters. And you see that because Jacob's not as advanced maybe as Joseph. He's mm-hmm. not near as wise at the mm-hmm. end. But there's definitely a kind of early Jacob and late Jacob.
Right.
And they're very different human beings.
Yeah, Jacob at the beginning is a liar. Who's, well, you know, his mom, Rebecca, eggs him on. But, you know, to get the blessing from their father, Isaac, even though he's the younger. And, of course, he does get that blessing. And so the younger leapfrogs over the elder brother, Esau, which is just the Joseph story, right? I mean, Joseph does – it's the youngest. Now, Benjamin is born later, if you remember the story. So Benjamin ultimately becomes the youngest. But at that moment, Joseph is the youngest of 11 brothers. And he leapfrogs over. He has – that's not supposed to happen, right? The elder brother is prized and valued, but Isaac values the younger – I mean, you could say too that Abraham valued the younger brother, which is Isaac, over Ishmael. You know, what's going on here?
Right.
You know, because this, you've got the leapfrogging of the younger over the elder brother. And what else do we have that in Genesis? Jacob and Esau, we have
Jacob
Joseph.
And, yeah, I mean, all the patriarch.
Abraham.
Patriarchal narratives there.
Right. And it seems like a pretty intentional theme.
Well, and maybe know? Say that you'll know more of the historical background, but we've talked before about how it's helpful to know that this was written at a time when Judah has survived
right.
the exile,
right.
and sort of as the, quote, younger brother,
mm-hmm.
the survivor is telling the story of the origins of Israel here.
Right.
So it's not that surprising that the younger brother tells a story where the younger brother leapfrogs the older brother.
Yeah, I mean, it could be this whole preference of the younger brother could be a big clue, and I think it is, about when this stuff was written and why the story was written the way that it was. Because, I mean, even going back, you have this theme already with Cain and Abel, right? Who's the younger brother is valued by God. Well, why is he valued? Well, did he give you better sacrifice? Well, not really. He gave like meat and Abel gave wheat, the fruit of the field. But both of those are commanded in the Bible, in Leviticus, for example. Like, there's nothing like lesser about
right, which is what I maybe
one.
Would have been taught. Like, well, the reason right. was is because
it's meat. We all like
yeah,
meat.
Meat.
Well, no, it's both. Everything belongs to God, and that's why the preference for Cain.
Actually, it was,
for Abel,
it was Jesus, by the way.
Jesus,
it's the blood is in the meat. There's no blood, and you need blood. And Jesus right. somehow Jesus. Is
okay, now
the
that's
answer.
An interesting interpretation. The question then becomes, of course, Jared. Is this what it meant when they wrote these stories? And it's highly unlikely. In fact, I'd say it's probably impossible. But Cain, you know, is valued over Abel, and no real clear reason is given. There's a little bit of ambiguity there. So you've got this theme in Genesis, and like, you know, Jared is saying, you continue in the Bible, and it's, you know, Moses is the deliverer, but he has an older brother, Aaron,
mm-hmm.
you know? And
David.
And then David, right? David's the youngest of whatever, seven brothers. And it's just a great story.
And,
you know?
And it's very explicit, right?
Yes.
I mean, even in David, it's sort of like he's going down the line
mm-hmm.
and he says, wait, is this everyone? Like it's like almost like they're trying to make the point. It's
right.
not just accidental.
Right.
It's like, let's
right.
make this a real thing here.
Right. And so David is the one who becomes king. You know, he's the one out shepherding sheep in the field, and he's the one that God wants as a preference of the younger over the elder. Solomon is not the oldest surviving son of David. He's the younger one. And so, and then you have the nation of Israel splitting after that into Israel in the north. And like Jared said before, the tribe of Judah almost sort of solo in the south. And Judah is one of the tribes of Israel. And Judah is the fourth born of Jacob and, oh gosh, remember my Bible stories, Leah, right? So the fourth born, not the youngest, but the youngest at least of that union up to that point. And the elder brothers there are Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. And Reuben, well, he gets knocked out of the way because he had sex with his father's concubine, and Simeon.
Very relatable
story. I know. Simeon and Levi, I guess they're the ones involved in the massacre of those who raped Dinah, right? So, and they sort of said, yeah, be circumcised and we'll leave you alone. But then when they were circumcised and in pain, they just killed them all. So anyway, Judah comes to the top. And one thing that it's hard to not notice in Genesis, but it's the prominence of the tribe of Judah. And you see that, for example, in Genesis 49, this is where Jacob gives sort of like a last farewell address before he dies. And he talks about each of his sons, and Judah gets a lot of important things said about him, and it's a pretty long section there compared to the others. So Judah is highlighted in that story. And, you know, the story of Judah and Tamar, which is not a great story, and I have a podcast on that. We're not getting into this here, but Judah and David are very parallel figures in this story, and you can just find that and listen to it and whatever. But, you know, Judah is very prominent. Judah is the one that survives. And it would make some sense for the survivors to write the story highlighting the importance of their own tradition. And that seems to be pretty clearly what's happening in these stories.
And it could be, I don't know the research on this, but either way you end up with this, whether it's Judah being able to kind of the survivors write the story, or even a lot of times it's the monarchy that shapes the annals. The kings shape how the history is written, and you have, you know, David and Solomon, who aren't firstborns, mm-hmm. being able to perhaps shape some of those stories as well.
Right. It's hard to know exactly when they were shaped, but there is a theme that runs through really this story from almost the dawn of creation, the Cain and Abel story, all the way into the exile. Because, you know, in a way, the little brother survives and wins out over the elder brothers. Well, that's the story of Israel nationally. You have Judah survives. Judah wins. Mm-hmm. You know, the northern tribes are gone. All you have left is Judah, and then eventually they become Judahites and Judeans and Jews and Jewish, and the whole tradition comes from that.
You know, you said something that I think leads us maybe into another theme. You talked about Simeon and Levi, and this they talk to these people about being circumcised, and then they use that basically while they were maimed and recovering to massacre them. That seems really cruel, and a cruel, pretty terrible, horrible trick.
Yeah.
But we have this theme of the trickster, right? So there's an ambiguity, mm-hmm. I think, in Genesis, and it goes into Exodus and throughout probably the whole Bible, between when are you lying and when are you tricking someone and when is that okay and when is that bad? Mm-hmm. There isn't actually a lot of outright condemnation of that kind of behavior. In some ways, it's lauded in some of these.
Well, sometimes it is with Judah with Simeon and Levi. And also, you know, the serpent in the garden is a trickster, and he tricks the woman.
So it seems bad, but then we have these narratives where it seems fine.
Like, I mean, just to get out of Genesis with the midwives, you know, in the first chapter of Exodus, where they're told by Pharaoh to kill all the male children because we don't want them to rebel. And these Hebrew midwives who are responsible for sort of helping to birth the Hebrew babies, they listen to God's voice. They don't do it. But when Pharaoh confronts them, they say, you know, we're trying our best here, but these Hebrew women are so vigorous. By the time we get there, you know, they popped out a kid. What do you want us to do? That's a lie, but they're rewarded by God for the lie. And that's what people who are out of power, that's what you do. You know, it's not a democratic society. You can't appeal to a court of law. You have to find a way to outwit those in power and sort of put them in their place.
And that's the ambiguity. And that also ties in, I think, with that wisdom theme of even the language you use, you outwit them.
Mm-hmm.
We don't call it, well, you lied and deceived them.
Right.
Well, you outwitted them.
You outwitted them. And the big example of that in Genesis is the story of Jacob outwitting his senile father, Isaac, and, you know, getting his elder brother's blessing and his birthright. And you know, poor Esau comes along and says, yeah, I'm ready for the blessing. And I was like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? I just gave that to your brother. You know, and of course, Esau is very mad about that. Of course, I don't blame him, you know. Yeah. But, you know,
I didn't realize he talked Isaac was in The Godfather.
He's in The Mafia. I know he's
I didn't know he's in The Sopranos.
I got it, but I can't refuse this thing.
Well,
coming,
yeah, I mean,
you come to me at my wedding, and you insult me. Come here, I gotta give you a kiss.
So what we'd expect is...
I'm done now. That's okay. That's enough of
in
that.
No, there'll be a whole episode later where you reenact biblical narratives according to Godfather.
Or all my favorite TV characters and movie characters.
Yeah. So, yeah, you started a little Simpsons, and then you ended a little Godfather.
Grandpa Simpson, right. Sort of effortlessly. See how skilled I am? Effortlessly just sliding right into...
But what we would expect, right, and this is for a podcast for another time, but we would expect if the Bible's kind of this moral document that gives us these moral guidelines, we'd expect Jacob to be condemned for his lying. He would get his comeuppance, and Esau would eventually win the day.
Yeah.
But his quote-unquote sin of lying and tricking his brother is actually blessed, and it goes unpunished.
Right, right. It goes unpunished. And you know, my students have asked, like, why does God let him lie? And I say pretty bluntly, that's a white person question, because black people already know. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to do things when you're disenfranchised. And that's exactly – see, I mean, Jacob is not in power. Isaac is in power, right? The midwives are not in power. Pharaoh's in power. And
culturally, Esau, even though he hasn't had the blessing, is in a privileged position.
He's in a privileged position. Now, he's a bit of an idiot. Hey, I'm hungry. Fine, I'll make you something. Give me your birthright. Okay. Whatever, you know, I mean, he's adult, but here's the thing, okay? Jacob, of course, gets his name changed to Israel. Jacob is Israel in the story. Who's Esau? Well, the Edomites, mm-hmm. right? And that's and here's this fascinating thing in Genesis 27, where Esau gets sort of like the runt blessing. He doesn't get the full one; he gets another one. And Isaac says, okay, here's your blessing. Basically, you're going to serve your brother, but there'll become a point in time when you're going to rebel from him and you're going to have your own freedom. Well, in the book of, you know, in the stories of the kings of Israel, it happens. You know, you have the Edomites are under the thumb of Judah for a period of time, but then they rebel. You know, that sort of ties in some of the themes we've been talking about, but because you have here a really nice example of how in Genesis, you're already seeing something of the political map of a later point in time, whether it's the monarchy or it could be the exile. You know, the prominence of Babylon, for example, the mm-hmm. Tower of Babel. What a bunch of morons. It's because of them we're all speaking bad languages. And, you know, it takes place in the plain of Shinar, which is in Babylon. And they're like – they really screwed everything up. And of course, that's Israel's arch enemy at the end of the story. They're the ones who take them into exile.
And to bring this full circle, we can interpret that and say, oh, these silly writers and editors, they didn't realize that they were showing their cards that this was written later by kind of geographically hinting at a current reality. It's sort of anachronistic. They're putting it – or you could say maybe that's the point. Maybe they are – these are veiled kind of slaps in the face at some point to Babylon.
Right.
And so it's not – and I just think there's this theme that we have of giving the Bible the benefit of the doubt, that
right.
these are smart people who historically have read the text way closer than anybody I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And they know what they're doing. And it's more an interesting question of why are these themes here? What are they trying to say than it is assuming we are smarter, we're better –
right.
Kind of that C.S. Lewis chronological snobbery where
right.
because we're so smart now, we can look down on these primitive writers and see mistakes, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
when really, if we would put that down and have a posture of humility, we might learn a thing or two.
Right. And again, one thing is true, that when you write about the past, you're starting to say something about your present. And that's certainly the case. And the Genesis traditions were used to tell something of, let's say, political significance for the Israelites. Because you can't divorce politics and religion in the ancient world. Those two things go hand in hand. And so you have these echoes, like the geopolitical map. You have the Babylonians. You have the Canaanites. The Canaanites show up in the flood story where, of course, you know, Ham uncovers his father's nakedness, whatever that means. That's like four podcasts right there. But he punishes when he wakes up from his drunken stupor. It's your own fault, Noah. When he wakes up from it, he curses not Ham, but he curses Canaan. One of Ham's four sons. Why that one? Well, you're getting a picture of where the story of Canaan is going to go. This is like the hated ancient enemy. And you have the Moabites and the Ammonites who are descended from the union of Lot and his daughters. They're the neighbors of Israel. And Egypt is there already. In Egypt, they have an ambiguous relationship with Egypt. Sometimes it's a threat. Sometimes it's their salvation. But, you know, Egypt, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Canaanites, the Babylonians, they're all sort of there in Genesis. And you're already seeing how later writers and later editors thought of these peoples, and we're seeing that. That's why it's really – it's under-reading Genesis. It's just a historical account. It's not. It's an ideological – theological account told in the form of stories.
Well, again, when we privilege facts as more important than meaning, like that this is something that tells us something significant. What's the meaning of this? I think that adds substance, that adds something. Mm-hmm. We tend to think it gets in the way of the true thing, which is the facts of this. Is this historically accurate?
Yeah.
And I just think that's like you said, it's an anemic way of reading. It just takes something away.
Yeah. And then just, you know, we're coming close to the end, I guess.
Yes, we are.
But just on that idea, though, and again, this is just something to think about, especially if this is new for you. A lot of people are comfortable with Genesis 1 to 11 as being, okay, it's not maybe historical. It's, you know, there's a garden with magic trees in it. There's this worldwide flood, which probably didn't happen. But you get to the Abraham story, and all of a sudden there's like, well, now we're in history. And that's a very artificial distinction in Genesis, especially, you know, for people who have studied Hebrew, the style just keeps going. You know,
It's not an abrupt shift.
It's not an abrupt shift. It's like this is a story that comes from different traditions that's woven together, but it is woven together. And it's very hard to make that hard and fast distinction. Now, maybe the story of Abraham is not mythic because technically it's not. Myth has to do with origins and the gods and like the time before time. That's the flood. That's the Garden of Eden. But there is maybe something of, and I think there definitely is, something of what we call a legendary character to Abraham. And people have compared it to like King Arthur, for example. But it's this figure from the past that, you know, maybe there is a historical kernel there, but we're not reading history. We're reading dialogues we don't have any access to, all of which are there to tell a story of what is God like? Who are we as the people of God? What does it mean to be Israel? And let's never go back to Babylon again. You know, the exile is over. Let's move forward from here and be obedient to God and not make mistakes that we've made in the past. You know, it's almost like a pep talk, some of the stuff. Genesis, you know, it's trying to move forward. So,
well, unfortunately, we are at the end of our time. But I would say if this is interesting to you, you'd like to learn more about Genesis.
Thank goodness there's a book.
There is a book, Genesis for Normal People. Just go to – it's on the homepage now. You can just go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com and you will not miss it if you look at that
page.
Oh,
it's in your face.
It's in your face. That's what we like. We like to be in your face.
That's how we do things.
Exactly. Yeah. So go there. Pick it up. That would be great.
We'll buy it.
Yeah.
Does that mean you pick it up?
You have to buy it. Yeah, I mean,
you can't actually pick it up because it's on the interwebs.
They ship it to you. Then you can pick it up once it comes in the box. You know how the drill goes.
Pick it up is just a nice way of saying give me money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But we like to be nice here.
Yeah, we're not.
So we're going to do that. So just, check that out. And also, maybe have more of these conversations. And we understand, again, if we read the Bible closely, it impacts how we think of Scripture in general. Like, you can't read Genesis in this way without it impacting your entire view of what the Bible is and what we do with it.
Yeah, and Genesis especially is sort of a laboratory for being engaged with, I was going to say being confronted with, but it doesn't have to be. It's more engaging perennial questions of interpretation of anything, almost anything in the Bible. Most of that stuff, folks, is right there already in the book of Genesis. That's why it's really worthy of our adult attention and our curiosity and our patience and our devotion to trying to understand it on its own terms as best as we can.
And lastly, we want to thank you. This is episode 100.
Yo!
And I cannot believe that Pete and I have not killed each other yet. It's a miracle. We want to celebrate that fact.
We've killed our cats and dogs, but we haven't taken it on each other.
That's right.
It's, you know, Jared used to have five kids, but now he has four. Thank goodness mine are out of the house.
So just want to thank you for following along, both listeners as well as all of our supporters on Patreon, those of who have engaged in the book study, in all of the Slack conversations, which there's just so much conversation going on. That was our original hope. was that this becomes a community of conversation, a community of support as we work through these challenges and issues of our faith in new and exciting and terrifying ways.
Right.
So thank you so much for being part of that journey, and we hope to have another 100 coming your way.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening.
See ya. Okay, here we go.
I just burped. David, you can leave that in there if you want.
All right.
By which I mean don't leave it in there. All right. And, you know, poor Esau comes along and says, yeah, I'm ready for the blessing. And I was like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? I just gave that to your brother. You know, and of course, Esau is very mad about that. Of course, I don't blame him, you know. Yeah. But, you know.
I didn't realize
he talked
Isaac
like that.
Was in The Godfather.
He's in The Mafia. I know he's.
I know he's in The Sopranos.
I can't refuse this thing. Huh? You come to me at my wedding, and you insult me. Come here, I gotta give you a kiss.
So what we'd expect is...
I'm done now. That's okay. That's enough.
There'll be a whole episode later where you reenact biblical narratives according to Godfather.
Or all my favorite TV characters and movie characters.
Yeah. So, yeah, you started a little Simpsons, and then you ended a little Godfather.
Grandpa Simpson, sort of effortlessly. See how skilled I am? Effortlessly just sliding right in.